Welcome back again to our Less Stress podcast. After some time, we're back with a new episode. So for those who don't know us, Less Stress is about traumas, embodiment, body practices, neuroscience, yoga and art that are exploring the links and dialogues between the disciplines and professions to help us all to connect our human system holistically, to self-regulate, to stress regulate and really regain our natural superpowers. So here today, I have for you prepared a conversation with Dr. Abba Rajbhandari. So Abba Rajbhandari is an assistant professor in the departments of psychiatry and neuroscience at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Rajbhandari obtained her PhD in neuroscience from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she studied the role of the amygdala subregions in regulation of stress and sensory motor gating. Dr. Rajbhandari did her postdoctoral work at the University of California, Los Angeles, where she studied fear and stress regulation via the amygdala. At the Icahn School of Medicine, Dr. Rajbhandari's team focuses on the brain, vagus nerve and body mechanisms of fear, stress and anxiety to understand how the body communicates with the brain in regulating these functions. Dr. Rajbhandari has also been a lifetime yoga practitioner since her childhood in Nepal. She teaches yoga classes in her spare time and also the spiritual aspects of yoga. I'm truly so happy to introduce you this complex human being, scientist, and a yoga practitioner. So these two wonderful things coexisting together make this episode really interesting. And as you can sense and feel, we're going to be discussing vagus nerve, body brain and brain to body connection. We're going to be talking polyvagal theory, how to regulate stress and fear responses. We'll talk about spirituality and yogic practices in the context of science and other way around. We're going to touch on some research, where to find it, how to try and find this research a bit more accessible, and many, many other things. So let's really dive into this and let's listen to this wonderful conversation. And if you want to follow us on Facebook as Less Stress Art and on Instagram as less.stress.art, as well as our Anchor FM website. And of course, you can find us on all popular favorite podcast platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcasts, and many more. So I'll see you on the other side. So hi, Abba. It's so nice to have you here today on our Less Stress podcast to talk about the neuroscience and the vagus nerve, and maybe hopefully a bit of about the polyvagal theory, about stress regulation, mindfulness, yoga practices, and other holistic practices too. I would like to maybe jump in and start straight away. So a very direct question in the beginning. So how did you decide to actually become a neuroscience? What exactly was so attracted to you to step into that field, which is actually quite wide, a science of the brain and pretty much all the systems? So,
first of all, thank you so much, Yuvile, for this invitation to talk at the Less Stress podcast. You're doing such an amazing job doing this. It's so important to bridge this gap, this communication between science and yoga and this holistic aspect. And it's really great to share some of my perspectives here. Yeah, so regarding the question about how I got into neuroscience, I think I have to go way back to when I was back in Nepal. So I came to the United States actually from Nepal to pursue an engineering degree. So, in Nepal, as a South Asian country, either, the options from parents are usually become a doctor, engineer, or a lawyer, right? So that's kind of what's expected. And so I sort of was taking these physics and biology courses and kind of was drawn towards physics. And so I came with a major in physics to the United States for my undergraduate at a small school in Missouri. It's Truman State University in Missouri. And so I was a physics major with a focus on electrical engineering. And I was taking all these physics and calculus courses. And I was doing okay in the calculus courses, but the physics was very tough, although I was drawn to some aspects of physics, it was very tough for me, to get good grades and stuff. And so I feel like I was doing that more as a pressure, to satisfy my parents' expectations. And so I ended up changing my university to a different place in Michigan, which gave me a international scholarship. And so I moved there and I decided I'm going to be an undecided major and try out a few different courses. So I was taking biology courses, I was taking physics courses, and many others, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to pursue. And so when I took some biology courses where there was a course on neuroscience, it just like opened my mind that brain is what I should study because this professor also played a huge role. She was really awesome in how she broke down aspects of neuroscience that are well described or well known, but things that are still remaining. And so that's where my journey began. And so I took that course and then ended up volunteering at University of Michigan in a lab that studied Parkinson's disease and Tourette syndrome. Because the school I went to was really small, it didn't have a lot of research in it, and so I ended up going there for almost 2 years. Going back and forth and volunteering in a lab whenever my time permitted from my coursework. And so the lab needed a technician that they were looking for. So after I finished my undergraduate, I applied and was accepted as a technician in the lab. And so I stayed there for 2 more years. And I learned a lot about neuroscience during that time. I think that really opened my door toward research because I understood how research occurs. And so after that, I ended up applying to graduate program at uni many different places, but ended at University of Wisconsin in Madison for my PhD in neuroscience there. And then the path of academia is so long. So then after that, I pursued my postdoctoral training at University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. And so both my graduate work and postdoctoral work was very much centered around studying how the amygdala, the part of the brain that's associated with fear regulation, how that modulates fear and stress. And so I continued on that path. And then when I started my lab here now, I'm looking at it more from a holistic, zoomed out perspective of this brain and body. So yeah, it's a journey for sure, right? So that's how it began.
Yeah, it absolutely sounds like quite a wavy path to towards that, but so inspiring and so beautiful actually. And I think it's perhaps important to mention a little bit that there is a quite a holistic reason, I believe. You can of course correct me if I'm wrong, but your kind of interest and of course the embodiment of the spirituality and mindfulness practices, which we will come back a bit later in our talk. But I think this body-mind study that you are taking in your scientific field as well is also because of that spirituality aspect. That's how it feels, at least a little bit. So now I'm just drawing off what you said now, and So I wanted to kind of step in into a bit more theoretical and also at the same time practical talk. So what could you tell us about, I guess, the polyvagal theory? I know it's quite wide and it involves many things, but nowadays in the yoga community and mindfulness community and other kind of holistic practices, we hear a lot about this, you know, parasympathetic activation, and that we need to always kind of be relaxed and be calm and all that stuff, and that the parasympathetic is actually the vagus nerve, which is the one is responsible for that. So can you actually try to tell us more, a bit more constructive and a bit more holistic sort of approach to this, in a sense, new concept of the importance of the parasympathetic activation and how it really works, and maybe in the context of the polyvagal theory. So anything that, you know, relates to your field of research, of course.
I'll go through it again. So the polyvagal theory, it talks about the autonomic function, which is important for us to navigate through the dynamic changes that we call life, right? There's a lot of stressors. And so there's that aspect, but it draws from a lot of influential researchers that came before. So, for example, talking about the homeostasis aspect of the body. So our body always tries to be in homeostasis, which means like this balance. Right, so that draws from Walter Cannon's work on this fight or flight system. There's also aspect of evolution from Charles Darwin, and there's a lot of this other aspect of nervous system and brain body interaction that it draws from. And so it is drawing a lot of the ideas of this brain body interaction, the sympathetic and parasympathetic, which I'll talk in more detail a little bit later, but let's focus on the polyvagal theory. And so, you know, it draws from those, and it talks about the bidirectional communication between our visceral organs like the heart, the lung, the gut, and brain structures and communication between those, and how brain regions modulate this information coming from the body in regards to stress-related signals, sensory signals, and many other type of signals that go into the brain. And so, you know, all those aspects of polyvagal are great, right? However, there are certain aspects of the polyvagal theory that are a bit difficult to prove empirically. And so, you know, it talks a lot about how we're in trauma and dangerous situation, how the sensory information coming from like the heart and the lung, the breathing information goes into the brain, and the brain regulates that, and in turn, specifically the brainstem structures that receive this information from the body and then send it into the forebrain structure, which are considered more these newer structures, right, that allowed us to evolve as human beings for this critical thinking, decision making, those type of abilities. And so it makes sense theoretically that our body processes this information from the body, or sorry, our brain processes the information from the body and sends that information to the brain, especially these forebrain structure, to modulate then the reaction that we have in face of a stressor, right? So evolutionarily, when we were a cave beings, I guess, we dealt with a lot of stressors, especially predators. We always had to be in this fight or flight mode to be safe from predators. And that's how we evolved. Our body evolved this systems to deal with those stressors so we could survive in face of that. And so it talks about this defense mechanism. That's one aspect. So the polyvagal aspect is divided into two aspects. One is this defense mechanism, the this old system that was conserved evolutionarily. And then there is this social engagement system that sort of is a newer system. So like us humans, how we recognize facial expressions, social settings, and all of that, and deal with that situation by an appropriate response to that. And so there's also another aspect where there's the aspect of neuroception, which means our brain is always scanning these different frequencies or changes or in the environment to then cause the physiology to change to in face of these situations, right? But these aspects make sense theoretically, but it's very difficult to prove empirically, because neuroception especially, right? Like how do we know exactly the brain is scanning and doing all these aspects? So for me as a neuroscientist, and specifically this empirical neuroscientist, it's hard to prove that. So there is that caveat, I would say. And a lot of diseases are associated with autonomic dysfunctions, but not all of them, right? So we cannot say all the diseases associated with the brain and body are associated with the autonomic function. And so overall, yes, the polyvagal theory saying how the vagus nerve is sort of this input structure into the brain from the body. And so any kind of changes in the body will be detected by the vagus nerve, and that's the information it's going to send into the brain. Totally makes sense, right? And that's why a lot of research related to gut or heart, cardiovascular diseases and stuff are associated with stress-related diseases, because it's possible, right, that vagus nerve is the carrier. But a lot of this research, I have to say, is ongoing. And so in regards to the work I'm doing, we are relating how stressors affect this information that's coming from the body, especially the heart related information or the breathing related information, and how vagus nerve integrates that in the brainstem structure. And then what happens when someone is going through stressor during that time, how is the information transferred, right? We have no idea. And we also have no idea what are the biological substrates of the vagus nerve itself, because it's a fiber bundle that's carrying a lot of information into the body, but we still don't know clearly what type of cells or what type of neuropeptides or what type of modulators are expressed in the vagus nerve, because not all the vagus nerve bundles carry every single information. It's probably divided into different categories, right? So for example, breathing related information has already been mapped out in the brain to be in a particular area of the brainstem. The gut related information is in a different area that the vagus inputs. Same with the heart. And so it's already divided, but what are the modulators? We don't know. And so I am coming into this research trying to understand specific neuromodulators that modulate the function of the vagus nerve, that in turn set the tone of the brain to then have different aspects regulated related to heart functions or lung functions or gut functions. And so hopefully that makes sense, that, you know, there's a lot of research that remains to be done in regards to the biological functions of the vagus itself. So we can then maybe in the future use those specific modulatory aspects to also regulate the brain in regards to these stress-related functions. And so that's the polyvagal sort of theory, you know, sort of the whole theory, and then also like breaking it down into these different parts. And one other thing I have to mention about the polyvagal is this aspect of immobilization or freezing behavior, right? So the two circuits I mentioned where it talks about the old circuit versus the new circuit, the social circuit, which is the newer, and the old circuit, the fear and fight or flight response, there's very little emphasis previously given to the freezing behavior. But some people have this freezing, right? This immobilization, yes, in front of a stressor. Mm-hmm. And so it talks about how the same kind of circuit is switching between these sort of behaviors, but also coming from this fear perspective, you know, studying amygdala in my previous work, a lot of that also hasn't been worked out, right? Like how exactly our body switches from a fight mode to a flight mode to a freezing mode. And is it the same circuits in the brain? These are all, I think, open questions, I would say. So a lot of research remains to be done. But yeah, theoretically, it does make sense. But I think as yoga practitioners who follow scientific pathway, or even as a researcher who is also following yoga, I think we have to look at the empirical evidences also to, you know, really buy into a theory. So yeah, that's what I would say about that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to mention that, I mean, I can anecdotally relate to the, you know, all those systems interchanging, because I could feel for a certain time in my life, you know, I used to react to the stress responses like in a more like a frozen kind of state. And then, you know, it would be more like anger or sort of running away from the stressors in that sense. So it was always like fluctuating. It was more the freeze mode was more sort of like a pattern, I guess, you know, also you can say related to certain traumas or childhood experience and etc. And I could feel that when I started kind of applying the more the yogic and the mindfulness practices, you know, it started moving to like somehow more anger expression and then to sort of more regulative mode, you know, like this more regulated state, as you called last time when we talked baseline, and that we need the balance of both of the systems, and we cannot just, you know, emphasize one as better and another as like the bad one, the bad guy. And I think it's so often nowadays that the parasympathetic is more emphasized and the sympathetic is like something that we should avoid, but it's not true. And I think we should kind of need to clarify these things, and especially for, I think, for the people that are listening to our podcast, to make it more understandable and in a sense that they could, you know, relate.
Yeah, the autonomic nervous system is basically means like systems in the brain and body that function automatically, right? So for example, breathing, heart rate and things, these are happening automatically. And we don't have to put thought into it or conscious thought. And so these are important systems. The autonomic systems are important to for us to be alive, right? And so so basically the autonomic nervous system is divided into the sympathetic and the parasympathetic systems. And the sympathetic we associate with this fight or flight response. And so basically these are responses or are associated with arousal in face of stressors, and also evolutionarily, like I talked about before, in face of a predator, our sympathetic system is the one that kept us alive in face of a predator, because we needed to take the action, these defense mechanisms to either be safe from the predator or feign death, right? So that the predator wouldn't attack us. And so the sympathetic system is very important, right? It for us for survival. And then the opposite, the parasympathetic nervous system, as you mentioned, which is modulated by the vagus nerve. Vagus nerve is not only the modulator, but it is a major regulator of the parasympathetic nervous system, it does the opposite. So it is more associated with this rest or digest or recuperating type of behavior. So even evolutionarily, when we face a predator, there we needed to calm down and then let our body recover from the stressor we just went through to be in balance. And so obviously both systems can't be active at the same time during those kind of moments, but in general homeostatic function, they are active at the same time. So they're more like this yin and a yang, so they have to be very much in balance. So if we have more of a sympathetic activation, that is also not good, right? Because that means we always have this high heart rate, increased breathing. So we're always in this aroused sort of state. But on the opposite hand, being extensively in parasympathetic mode is also not always good, right? So because we need the sympathetic to balance it out. So because enhanced levels of parasympathetic can also lead to some negative aspects. And so like decreased metabolism, because that's when metabolism decreases. It's also important for immune function, but at the same time, long-term activation is also not good. So that's why, you know, I think holistic practices do balance the sympathetic and parasympathetic by activating both of them. And so the most important thing is, from a scientific end, we don't know how these systems interact or with each other or talk to each other. We know there are these parallel systems, but we still don't know what is the mechanism that allows them to converse with each other, to tell, okay, sympathetic when it's activated, to activate now the parasympathetic. So that again relates to what I talked about previously in terms of these biological mechanisms of what are the modulators that are expressed in these systems. We know somewhat about the sympathetic system in regards to norepinephrine, and parasympathetic, there is acetylcholine, but we know very little in terms of how they're interacting with each other at the level of the body. And so, yeah, it's important, I think, from a yogic perspective to make sure that both of these systems are in balance. So that's what I would say.
And just while listening to you, thought popped into my mind about actually that so many of these researches about all these systems and how it works together, the parasympathetic and sympathetic and the vagus nerve, is still so much in the process, and so many things are not really known in that sense. So it's a good time to be and live and explore these things. So, but I want to go back to the research towards the end, and now I kind of want to go back to a bit more of the polyvagal and the vagus and the body and the mind interaction, or the organs and the brain, and I'm always thinking so. So it definitely interacts both ways, yes. So the organs do communicate with the brain, as well as the brain communicate with the organs. But do we have any evidence which actually affects how the one affects the other and where it really starts? So for example, if the brain, if there's even a way to explain this way, but for example, if the brain somehow realizes it's in a kind of in a stress mode. So is it the first to realize, or actually the organs and our bodily system does realize that first in that sense? And what's the working between these two, and how do we know which affects the other, and when and how, and especially of course related to stress and chronic stress and etc.
Definitely. Yeah, I think you're touching on, I think, the big question of today's world right now, especially in this brain and body interaction field, because the field has been so brain-centric, right? So a lot of neural mechanisms and neural circuitry related to these, like I said, fight or flight or freeze mode has been really nicely worked out. Like, for example, how the amygdala interacts with the prefrontal cortex, which is important for this decision-making in face of a stressor situation, has been worked out really well. But like you said, we know, like, when someone is in a stressful mode or under stress, the bodily actions like the heart rate, breathing, and all are increased. But so little emphasis has been given on these brain-centric studies on those that it's a little bit hard to integrate them together, because there's a lot of cardiovascular-related research that's happening that's looking at how stressor or metabolic function alters cardiovascular diseases, right? And so they're looking at heart rate and lung functions and gut functions on that end. And then there's neural studies that are looking at how exactly like the hippocampus is important for memory functions. The amygdala is associated with the fear-related function, prefrontal cortex for these critical thinking, decision-making kind of abilities. And the interactions between them are studied. But you're going back to your question about what happens first. Like when we're under a stressful situation, does our heart rate start going first and our breathing, and then that information goes to the brain and then brain makes the decision? That's a very fast time scale, right? So in research right now, to be honest, that hasn't been worked out. What is the thought is that it's all top down, right? The thought right now is that brain, for example, our visual system, our olfactory system senses danger, and then brain says, okay, let's be in this mode to deal with this stressor. And then it causes all the motor function, you know, to lead into this fight or flight or freeze mode. And so we go into that mode. And to get into a little bit more nitpicky detail, so the vagus nerve carries about 80 to 85% information from the body to the brain, but it also carries a few, like 10 to 12% information back to the body, right? So most of what it is doing, it's carrying information into the brain. So it has to have importance in modulating the brain functions. And so a lot of researchers that I also collaborate with, for example, the gut function, how that modulates all the way to the brain function related to food related behavior, so feeding behavior, has been very well worked out. But in regards to heart rate changes and breathing changes, what comes first, that hasn't been. So the vagus nerve inputs into this brainstem structure called the nucleus of the solitary tract in the brainstem. It's also called NTS for short, which is also a major input site where the heart, lung, gut, and other information are sort of divided. And then in turn, NTS sends information to another brainstem structure called the locus coeruleus, or LC for short, I'll say. And so the LC is a major region in the brainstem that releases norepinephrine into the entire brain, forebrain. And so when we're in this stressful mode, what is very well worked out in the field is that the locus coeruleus, LC, releases this norepinephrine into the brain structures like the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, the hippocampus, and many other regions, telling those brain regions, okay, something significant has occurred. And so now, you know, activate the receptors on which norepinephrine acts on. And so those brain regions then also communicate with each other to then cause appropriate reactions, right? So amygdala and hypothalamus, for example, are associated with also regulating heart rate and breathing. But like I said, there is a huge divide right now in regards to what happens. So you're, you know, what happens first? And so you're touching into a very, very important question, I think, in the field right now of the brain and body interaction. And so like I'll say, everything, or not everything, a lot of things related to brain functions of these stressful situations has been worked out, but its interaction with the body, that's an ongoing body of work right now. And I think a lot will come out in the next 4 or 5 years, I believe, because there is a lot of researchers now looking into these different aspects I just talked about, into heart and gut function. The gut function has been very well worked out so far, and we know that it's important. But yeah, so you know, all of these are very important questions, because the brain doesn't work in isolation from the body, right? It's all constantly communicating with the body. But even as a neuroscientist, I feel like I used to look at brain regions kind of in isolation from the body. Like I used to only look at a certain structure and try to find the function of that structure. But I'm verging or zooming out of that a little bit now.
So we do know that chronic or unfinished stress tends to kind of stay or remain in the body for longer periods of time, even if the stress or the stressors that causing the stress are already finished. But so as you're saying that we don't really know, we don't have as much like evident research on that, but like there's still a lot of information and the scientists talking and holistic practitioners talking that, you know, like our breathing gets disturbed, there something happens with our cardiovascular health, and of course our digestive system gets dysregulated. So could you tell a little bit about that, you know, how we can actually, well, first of all, how that happens, you know, this mechanics behind that, and what actually, well, of course we're already slowly entering into what are the ways to avoid that, or at least regulate that a little bit, or protect ourselves from this physical damage.
Yeah, that's very important. And it is matter of fact that our body is affected under stressful situation, right? There's no doubt about that. It's just like how neuroscience integrates this information about the body with the brain. That's the part that's a little bit empirically not worked out. But how exactly that happens? So, you know, in a normal situation, or normal meaning homeostatic situation from a scientific perspective, you know, our brain and body are interacting with each other and telling it like there's no danger, you know, no need to increase the heart rate, no need to change the breathing rate. And so in that sense, when a stressor comes into come into play, for example, combat situation, for example, veterans who come back from combat, or firefighters who've been through a traumatic situation, what happens is, in that trauma situation, they experience, you know, this fight or flight response, because the sympathetic activation occurs at a much higher level. And so then that causes norepinephrine to be released, like I said, from the locus coeruleus into the entire forebrain axis, and causes then information to be sent to the body organs like the heart and lung to increase breath rate and heart rate to, you know, flee from that situation or fight in that situation. And so when these people who face trauma come back to a safe environment, you know, it's a safe environment, it shouldn't cause any kind of state of panic or this increased breathing rate or heart rate, but there is some trigger in that environment, right? A cue that serves as a reminder of that trauma. So for example, for a combat veteran who has come back from that trauma situation, months or years later, a helicopter may be flying on the, you know, in the sky, and it will trigger reminders or memories of that trauma. So exactly what had happened during that trauma situation, and it will cause the body to have the same reaction it had during the trauma in this same environment, in the safe environment, right, where they shouldn't have this increased heart rate or breathing rate and stuff. And so that is associated specifically, and it has been worked out very well in neuroscience, is related to the memory of the trauma, right? Because the cue served as a reminder of the trauma, and that's why it's causing now the body to have this reaction to a safe cue, even though, you know, a car door slamming, for example, is a safe thing. It's not something that should trigger a traumatic reaction. And so, yes, like I said, in terms of the memory aspect, the fear related memory, how the amygdala and hippocampus, so hippocampus is important for the contextual aspect, or the contextual aspect related to the memory of that trauma. And so it sends information to the amygdala, which then processes information by sending information to downstream structures that then modulate this freeze or fight or flight responses through brainstem structures. So there is this bi-directional sort of communication happening between the brain sending information to the body, but then the body also sending information to the brain, because that mode of fight or flight or freeze has to shut down at some point, right? It cannot go on, because if it goes on, then that's not good for the brain and body. So the body does have this compensatory mechanism for it to shut that mode down. And so then the parasympathetic comes into play, which is the vagus nerve, because it will tell this is a safe environment, no need to panic, to the brainstem structures, which then sends information to the forebrain that are then communicating and then bringing the sympathetic, this defensive reaction down. But it's precisely how that occurs in the brainstem, this information going from the brain to the body and then the body telling the brain again. That is an open question. That's not very well worked out at all. Because we know more theoretically that happens, and we know aspects of that, like the brain telling the body, somewhat has been worked out. But the body telling the brain, that's, like I said, it's a very, very ongoing sort of research right now. But we know this happens, right? Like Walter Cannon's work on fight or flight mechanism that focused on the body. A lot of previous other researchers had sort of already emphasized the importance of this body information going into the brain. So no doubt, like the question you asked are all have these interrelated aspects to stress and this brain-body communication for sure.
Wow, that's super complex. As I feel, you know, people always looking for a solution to the problem, you know, especially those of us that, you know, are not, I don't know, so much scientifically educated or we don't, you know, we don't understand that much of that theoretical aspect of all these complex complex systems working in our body and our brain. So I think it's very important to kind of slightly come to the yogic and mindfulness practices and meditation, of course, and relate that to how these can help us to regulate, you know, our system in general, and of course to regulate the stress, because again I often hear this phrasing of we need to fight the stress, you know, we need to kill the stress, but I don't think that's necessarily true, because stress is important for us as well as anything else, and we just need to learn how to regulate that response so it does not affect us in that, you know, as you said, in this continuous, chronic, repetitive kind of mode and state. So yeah, how these holistic practices, including yoga, meditation, mindfulness, does help to regulate stress in that sense. And maybe there are other things as well that are not necessarily those practices that help, that also are important to mention.
I think it's more important than ever with like the COVID-19 pandemic type of stressors that are going to keep increasing in our society, right? So the thing is, I think one of the biggest perspectives of yoga is that the situation outside of us is never going to be in our control, right? It's always changing. But what happens inside us is in our control. And so what I like to look at from a both scientific and the spiritual aspect of yoga is that, you know, even though the autonomic functions are autonomic, right? They're happening automatic, but there is one autonomic function that is under our control, and that is breathing. So breathing is one of those autonomic functions, even though it happens all the time. We don't have to put conscious thought towards it. You know, it's happening when we're in a stressful mode, where it's happening when we're in a calm mode, but we can control how we breathe. And so I think the core part of yoga or these other brain body or mind body practices like Tai Chi, or even I would even put dance into that category, because I feel like dance is also this rhythm of integrating brain and body aspect, and especially breathing, is that that's something we can consciously control. By slowing down our breathing, we are telling the body's sympathetic system to slow down and not tell the forebrain structure to be in this state of fight or flight mode, right? And so I think the Yoga's Chitta Vritti Nirodha, which is one of the sutras of Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, is very encompassing, because what it means is yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind, right? It is definitely so easy to say that, right? Like, control your mind and you've solved your problem. But, you know, it is something that we can do, and it doesn't happen, like, I think, in an instant. Like, I know, so I see some people taking one or two yoga classes and they'll say, like, it didn't do anything to me, so it doesn't work for me, and they won't practice it, right? So it's very important, just like brushing our teeth. So we brush our teeth every morning and every night, and to continue the health of our teeth, I think we have to continue that. We cannot give up, because even if we don't brush for one day, it's not good for us, right? So I think from that end, yoga and these mindfulness practices are very much a practice, because we have to do them every single day for it to have an effect. And so from a scientific end, I think what ends up happening when we adopt these practices is that the body learns, even under stressful situations, that, okay, it learns to scan the situation and be like, okay, this is not a state that I need to be stressed about. And it'll automatically start to bring the body down into this more calmer state. And so I think the old, like, Vedic sort of meditation practices, they emphasize practicing at least 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at night. And even scientific evidence shows now that, you know, this practice that affects, you know, in terms of thinking abilities, these arousal functions and other types of aspects related to brain functions work when it's practiced or when it's tested in people who are regular practitioners versus who've only done, like, once or twice, or even people who have never done it. There's definitely scientific evidence showing that yoga has a beneficial effect in regards to these many aspects of attention, memory processing, you know, stress regulation, sleep, and all of this when someone practices for a long time. So I would say any of these practices, whatever works, like, for example, there are studies showing when you combine aerobic exercise with yoga practice can have a much beneficial effects for, especially this has been tested in victims of trauma, especially women, and they, when they've got combined aerobic exercises with doing these mindful practices or meditation practices, it has had much better outcome on how they evaluate their stressful situation or, you know, being in this calm sort of state. And so I think my perspective from a scientific end, there's a lot of research on exercise alone that has been done. There's a lot of research on yoga, but yoga is a more, like, holistic, all-encompassing, because it has this physical aspect, but also this mental aspect that's key, right? And I think the key is this mental aspect of, you know, being in meditation or practicing the breathing practices like pranayama. I think combining all of those can have a much better outcome on our holistic health for sure.
And I believe that, you know, even the asana practice does involve asanas that are more calming, and some of them are, you know, more activating as well. So again, it's like combined things together, you know, we don't separate one from each other as one of the better and another is the worse. And I also, because I know that I remember a little bit that at the neuroscience conference that happened this year in spring, there were definitely a few researchers were presented about some of the pranayama practices. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, more calming pranayama like Anuloma Vilom, and then more activating ones like Kapalabhati or Bhastrika. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how differently both of these act kind of affect us in a way.
The pranayama practices, you know, it's usually lumped into the same, and people feel, at least I know a few people who think pranayama is always about parasympathetic activation, right? And it's not the case, as you just brought up, because there are these more sort of vigorous kind of breathing, and there are these more calming kind of breathing. And so specifically, the Bhastrika pranayama or Kapalbhati, they are focused on increasing the breathing like at a very fast pace, like especially Kapalbhati. So that means it's activating the sympathetic nervous system. It's activating, you're increasing your heart rate. You can, if you practice that, you may notice that your heart rate is increasing, and obviously your breathing is changed, right? And so that's putting the body, that is important. And so, like I said, both sympathetic and parasympathetic are important. And so activating the body that way in sympathetic mode is good. Like you are, increasing your alertness, you're increasing your attention, because you might notice if you practice this Kapalbhati pranayama, you tend to be in this very like excited, like aroused sort of state. And then opposite of that, like for example, the humming bee breath, that breathing, or the anulom vilom and that kind of breathing, they are very much parasympathetic activation, because they are bringing the body into this calm mode. And so a lot of times in yoga, these pranayama practices are also practiced during asana practice, right? And so during asana practice, for example, doing a headstand or a handstand, it's not saying that they're not good. They are fine, but they increase heart rate, right? But they have to be balanced by doing then later, other breathing practices that bring the body down. So just like, I find sometimes yoga practitioners will just go into like doing a headstand or a handstand, and that's it. Like, the whole class is focused on getting into a headstand or a handstand, and the class ends with that. It begins with that focus, ends with that focus, right? So you're kind of left in this sort of increased aroused sort of state, and you have not brought the body down to the homeostatic level. And so I think the key important thing with any of these pranayama practices is the balance, right? So where you do it, entire yoga practice, there are certain places where you place them. Like, for example, the Bhastrika goes well with doing like a warrior pose, for example. And then there are other asanas where you can incorporate Kapalbhati when you're sitting down and before going into some kind of meditation practice to do, to bring the body down into this calm state. So I think the key thing with any of these practices are they are meant, or they are made in such a way that they activate both the sympathetic and parasympathetic. The asanas also, they activate the sympathetic and parasympathetic, like you mentioned, right? But just focusing on, I think, one aspect is not good for the body and brain, because it might have negative consequences. So I think practicing the entire yoga aspects of these pranayama, the asana, the meditation is the key also, or some kind of calming down with shavasana or something like that, right? So it's all about balancing, right? I think that's what yoga is about, is eventually having control over your body so that you can have this control over your mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just thought, how it is then, for example, we practice Kapalabhati, and then it's so often done before the meditation or as a preparation for a meditation. And how does that actually happen, that this pranayama in particular is actually activating, but somehow it does prepare our nervous system for diving deeper into the sort of this inner focus mode.
I think this is more theory, right, rather than scientific, because we don't know the evidence exactly. But from that end, I would think that because Kapalbhati is bringing yourself into this alert sort of mode, right, because you don't want to be sleeping or fall asleep when you are doing your meditation practice. So I think by controlling the breath and the body, it is causing your brain to be in this alert state. And usually after Kapalbhati, you do normalize your breathing before you go into meditation, either through some other pranayama practice or normalizing your breathing, coming back to your normal rhythm of breathing before you do the meditation, right? You wouldn't sit down to do meditation in that like increased like state. So I think it's a preparation toward being in the calm state, but I think there has to be something in between before you do the meditation itself, so that then you can have this alert focus on whatever you're focusing on, either mantra or light or sound or whatever. And I think it is very helpful when you do the Kapalbhati, even before asana practice, for example. I think when it's placed in certain order, I think it really energizes the body, and then later calming it down with, you know, shavasana or meditation, I think. Yeah. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I can usually feel the focus gets more enhanced. And you know, it's important to have that inner focus, your, you know, interoception, how your body feels during the practice. And then so the, you know, your senses do not go anywhere they want. So I think in that sense, for me personally, that's how it usually feels like. In your thinking or in your experience, in your embodied experience, because I feel it's so important to have this kind of cross-disciplinary approach to our holistic health. For example, you coming, bringing science and spirituality both at the same time, and you are already somehow seeing this body-mind connection quite naturally in that sense. So you don't, of course you are researching and you know, in that field of science, but somehow I feel like somewhere deep inside you already know that of course they affect each other, and we need that union rather than the separation you know, body, mind, and also the soul part as well, which is, I feel it's important. So I thought, do you have anything to say on that from either your personal or your professional, and anything really?
Yeah, I think from the professional end, that's a very important thing. Like now the brain and body interactions, I think understanding the underlying human biology, especially in front of stressors, from this cross-disciplinary point of view, is more important than ever, right? For example, brain and immune function, brain and gut function, and connecting, you know, for example, disciplines of neurology or neuroscience with cardiology, gastroenterology, pulmonology, all of these are super important. And, you know, the place where I work at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, we just also launched a brain-body center couple of weeks ago to bring researchers, like I said, because researchers working on these body stuff are so separate from researchers who work on the brain, neuroscience, and for example, these all the fields I just described. And so I think integrating them in from a scientific perspective is very important from that, so we can interrogate with each other, build relationships, and understand how brain and body are interacting. From the end of spirituality and more so this holistic perspective, also I feel like this is the time more than ever, just like in science, to also look at things from a much wider sort of viewpoint, right? So sometimes we tend to be restricted to just what we learn in books, or what books are great, you know, they teach us, but they're not everything, right? Sometimes experience is also very important. And I think, you know, we understanding ourselves from our own perspective is the most important thing, I think, in this time. And so when we only look at outside resources sometimes, like the books or knowledge from outside, then we miss what we are really inside, right? And so for me, the spirituality end of it is not related to religion. Like, you know, people relate spirituality to religion, and even in the culture I come from the Sanatana Dharma culture, you know, a lot of times the religious aspect are very much entangled with the spiritual aspect. But the spiritual questions are quite separate from those religious aspects, right? It doesn't require anybody to even go into a temple or do any kind of like rituals and stuff. It's more about asking these big questions, right? What is my purpose in this cosmos, in this big, you know, cosmos? Like, why am I here? Like, so for me, that is spirituality. And I find sometimes these answers when I am practicing meditation and stuff. Like, you know, I don't always come to a conclusion, but I do find hints of answers of like, okay, what is the purpose of being a human being and stuff? So I think understanding spirituality, I think yoga allows us to do that, right? We're always in this like outward sort of mode where we're either trying to please someone else or we're trying to get our job done. We're always in this outward mode. But finding this time, even like 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes at night, or even 5 minutes before bed, is super important to really understand, right? It's not always like questioning, but just sitting there and kind of letting things sort of happen. And so for me, that those kind of experiences have been profound. And so it has led me to dig deeper into these questions from both the scientific end and spirituality. So for me, the spirituality and science are very much related. I feel like science cannot work without spirituality, and spirituality cannot work without science. And again, I'm emphasizing not the religious, but the spiritual questions, because what science is asking at the core is also the same kind of questions. By understanding how our biology works, how our brain functions, we are at the core asking, who are we, right? And the same thing with spiritual questions are also same kind of questions. It's just the approach is different. Scientific is very empirical. You do experiments and you have to prove what you're researching. But sometimes experience of that spirituality may be sufficient also. So yeah, for bottom line, I think For me, right? Like even though as a scientist, sometimes I get called out for being spiritual. But I think for me, that's the way I look at spirituality, is these questions, because it's a never-ending path when you go into this path of questioning, right? In both science and spirituality. So that's what I would like to share. I think it's so important to be open to learning from ourselves also and from outside.
Yeah. It's so interesting to listen to that, and I'm just so glad that there are people like you that are actually looking at things this way. And I think it's so important to continue doing this way rather than compartmentalizing ourselves into different parts, you know. And I feel the thing, as you said, to sort of I guess this baseline or to come back to this mode of flow and sort of resetting everything and just kind of seeing things from this inner space. it's just so important in many aspects on the life. And it, for me, it always comes as like a sort of an embodiment of experience and theory and scientific theory. And it feels one thing is to, you know, to read a great theoretical, text or a research paper, and then to actually experience and embody that thing. And those two things coming together is really magical, I would say.
Yeah, some of the things are not exactly described in words, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's important to be open to both, like the science and the experience of itself.
Exactly. So it's so nice to have scientists in our world that actually see it as a kind of open open space and us as open, you know, source and explore it from both ends. So it's great. Yeah. And so one of my last questions would be, so I actually talked about that a little bit with Jonathan in our podcasts before, but I still feel that sometimes, especially in a yoga community, people tend to sort of be a bit skeptical about, oh, why do we need this research? You know, we're already experiencing and it's already clear. that's, you know, the experience is most important and we just need to trust and so on and so on. But I feel, again, this aspect of, in a way, explaining those experiences in scientific words, in scientific terms, can really bring, you know, the different sort of power to the society and to the world and access more people and kind of draw more people towards those practices rather than keeping them purely spiritual in a sense that it doesn't need an explanation. So yeah, I just, what's your take on that research and how we could be more sort of draw to collaborate even the practitioners and the scientists in that sense?
Yeah, that's a very valid question, right? It's so important. And there are a few researchers who are already doing that. For example, Richard Davidson at UW-Madison, like he actually does functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, in people like monks, right, who are long-term meditation practitioners. And he's a scientist, he's a neuroscientist, but he records their brain activity and versus someone who has never done meditation practice and compares. And that kind of data, like you said, it's super important, right? Because what happens in this, the spiritual aspect of yoga doesn't get translated into science. And so for scientists to really believe and get more funding, for example, for people to adopt these practices and stuff, or find ways of tapping into certain aspects that these practices utilize to then develop maybe tools or techniques, biological tools or techniques to have similar effect. Because, you know, to be honest, not everybody is going to be open to going to yoga class and taking yoga practice. You know, let's be honest about that, because people have a very, people are going to always be hesitant to do something that's out of their comfort zone. It's just like going to a therapist. Not everybody that suffers through mental illness goes to a therapist, because it may help, it may not help, but it's just getting people out, right? So for those kind of people, instead of doing yoga practice, if we can convince them, great. If not, like if there's a way to tap into these biological mechanisms to have similar effects, then maybe that's a way for them, right? And so it's not ideal, but this is how the world functions, right? And so I think it's so important. That's why that scientifically we have evidence showing how exactly or how, you know, at what level. I know it's like a dose response kind of effect, kind of questions like at what, how much meditation do you need, right? For you to have this effect of being calm or dealing with stressors or even having good sleep. You know, those kind of nuanced questions are super important, I think, for scientists. And sometimes they can be proven empirically by certain procedures, right? Like, for example, comparing someone who does meditation like 20 minutes a day versus someone who does 5 minutes a day. So you're kind of looking at the effects. And so I think for scientists, those types of doses or effects are super important. And also, I think to bring that to the public in terms of any kind of treatment options or things like that, that's why the science and this spirituality, I think merging them in some sort of way, especially in the yoga field, I think would help a lot more people for sure. So yeah, you're touching on a very important point that we have to look at it from both of those ends.
Yeah. So, now, one of my last questions. So What are you currently working on in terms of research? And also, where could we find maybe more research on the vagus nerve and the stress and all these things that I actually talked today on here? And do you think the research is enough accessible to the general public?
Yeah, that is a bit of a difficulty I also find, the science communication, right? What happens in a lab setting sometimes doesn't get well translated to general people. But what I encourage as a scientist for anybody, I know some of these papers are very complicated to read in regards to the methodological details and stuff, but I think it's really important to go into the original article. So for example, about the vagus nerve, not just like Google searching about what vagus nerve is and how it helps parasympathetic and then making your conclusions based on that. Because like I said, there's so many of these nuanced details that are not known. And so just generally following that, I think going into original articles and at least reading aspects of those articles and what they researched. I mean, every single figure in that paper may not be easily, easy to read, but I think it's still important to go into not the flashy sort of conclusion that someone else makes about that science, but to go into the work of those researchers and see what they're finding, because usually they're doing very small parts of that question, right? And it's not answered. So there are researchers to answer a question about where to find it. There are researchers at Harvard who are looking at only how the vagus nerve, like what are the cell types in the vagus nerve, so you can get some information on like how neuromodulation of vagus happens and how that might then in turn affect the brain function. There are questions. So my lab, we're asking questions about how the heart-related information is carried by the vagus nerve and how that is integrated in the nucleus of the solitary tract. And so specifically, I focus on certain neuromodulators like norepinephrine. There's this neuromodulator called PACAP in short. It's called pituitary adenylate cyclase activating peptide, very long name. How that and CRF, corticotropin releasing factor, these are all associated with fear and stress. And so specifically how they are expressed in these vagal pathways, how they modulate the function of the brainstem, that in turn, how it modulates function in response to stressors. And so a lot of my work is ongoing, and this, because like I said, is a new line of work and I haven't published yet on this, but for example, my lab website would be a good place. And same with researchers, I think going into their lab websites, people who are doing these vagus studies and going and reading the papers that they have published, I think could be a good start. You know, it is a lot to take, even for me as a scientist, in terms of reading and figuring out what's happening. But I think always, I think it's important to either talk to scientists or read papers or, you know, find some authentic sort of sources rather than like conclusions that are drawn in like a Google search, for example, right? So I think that's what I would emphasize.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Well, I'll try to put some of the links hopefully in the description of the episode as well afterwards. So yeah, it's super good. And the last question would be very simple, actually, coming to a very simple end. Maybe not so simple, but I think important. What is actually less stress for you? And how do you access that part in you that is less stressed rather than more stressed?
I think less stress for me, because stressors, like I said, I think I'm going to go back to what I said in the very beginning of the podcast, is that this outside world is never in our control, right? What happens in the outside. And so for me, less stress is even being in a mode where I can drink a cup of tea with a little bit of, you know, relaxed sort of feeling. It doesn't have to be something big, right? It doesn't, like, I think being in a non-stress kind of mode for anybody in the modern day is actually very difficult, right? We are always bombarded by stressors all the time. And if we are in a career career field, for example, in academia, which is full of stressors all the time. And there's not always like, you know, perfect moments or perfect days, but I think for me are those small moments, right? Because they set the tone for those bigger kind of events. When I'm able to control my stressor during these small moments, like drinking tea or when my meditation practice and stuff, I think when I go on to then have these stressful moments, then automatically I can tell my brain that this, you know, I don't need to be this stressed, right? So I think the feedback loop, this biofeedback loop starts to develop much more efficiently when you're practicing, continuing to practice to observe and be mindful of how you're reacting to a particular stressor. And so I think it's more about observing and being mindful. And that's what this path of yoga teaches you, right? Of noticing. And so it's like I said, it's not always perfect. You're not going to have the correct reaction every time. But over time, I think it helps incrementally.
Amazing. so nice. So again, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I could really talk on and on. I could continue on this for a long time. But I think we can, if we want to kind of follow you and your work, there's definitely a good combination on your Instagram account. So could you be so kind and tell us the exact name of it? I know I'll put it in the description, but if that's okay.
My Instagram account is a mixed bag of multiple things. I share, like, you know, aspects of myself, like spirituality, yoga, healthy eating, and all of that. So it's Neuro Namaste Nature Nourish. And so that's why it covers, you know, the neuroscience aspect, namaste is yoga aspect, nourish is food, nature, which, you know, nature is also a great healer under stressful conditions. So that's kind of what, you know, that's why it's a mixed bag. And basically, it's like a representation of who I am in a way. So yeah, so feel free to follow me there.
Yeah, it's so well combined. So thank you so much one more time. And
Thank you for the invite. And yeah, I think it's a good time, right, to continue on this path and learn more.
If you reached to this point, I hope that you thoroughly enjoyed our conversation with Abba, and I'm truly, truly grateful for that. I wanted to mention that now you can support us on Patreon, so we can continue finding those amazing speakers all around the world and just continue making our podcast, really. You can go there, our account is Less Stress, and contribute any amount you like. Thank you so much, and I'll speak to you soon.